the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, and this morning we speak with Bryce Baker, co-founder of Amico Health. Bryce will discuss the organization's mission to address youth mental health issues exacerbated by social media. Amico Health is a for-profit entity and collaborates with nonprofits like Live Like Sam. The program, delivered in schools and organizations, focuses on psychoeducation, teaching students about digital wellness, cyberbullying, and body image. It's part of our new monthly series called Resilient Youth, brought to you in part by Live Like Sam. Then in the second half, Autumn Bear, the founder of the new Autumn Bear Wellness Collective in Park City, joins the show. The new collective features health-forward practitioners providing patients with a proactive, well-rounded health and healing journey. That all coming up this hour on The Mountain Life. Stay with us. We'll be back after these words. Welcome back to The Mountain Life. I'm Lynn Ware Peak. Social media and the digital world affect all our lives profoundly. Even as we may utter that it affects us negatively, we check our phones to look at something. Our next guest is the co-founder of Amico Health, Bryce Baker. Bryce grew up in Park City and maintains close ties to the community. Amico Health addresses the impact of social media on youth mental health.
Inspired by what's going on in the digital world and how it affects especially youth mental health, Amico Health
aims to empower students, parents, and educators with tools to navigate digital spaces safely. Bryce Baker joins us as part of our monthly feature, Resilient Youth, brought to you in part by Live Like Sam. Bryce, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Thanks. I'm very familiar with it, as you know, because I grew up around Park City.
Yes. You know, I wanted to ask you first, how would you describe a digitally well person?
Well, it's different for everybody, but I think you want digital to be a tool, not something that blocks you from doing the things you want to do. So for people that could mean a different amount of hours or different use cases, but you want it to be a tool. You want it to be like a bicycle where it helps you get from point A to point B more quickly, not like something that, you know, makes it take 10 times the amount of time that it should take.
That's a good point. And how would you describe a person who is digitally unwell?
Well, if you're trying to get from point A to point B and it should take you an hour and it takes you 10 hours, there's probably something going on there. And the side effects now have been proven to be, you know, they're far and wide, but there can be some really negative side effects if you aren't doing that and you are digitally unwell. For some folks, it's, you know, it could be as simple as taking a really long time to do their homework as a kid, but it can certainly go much further than that, unfortunately.
So talk to us a little about how you and why you founded Amico Health.
Yeah, so I think, you know, there's been a lot in the news. I'd say even particularly last year and the year before was kind of the big news cycle for, are we sure that we're kind of keeping our own use of tech in check? And I think, you know, you've seen a lot of different groups come forward and say, you know, these social media companies shouldn't be allowed to do this or shouldn't be allowed to do that. And at the end of the day, legislation and all these different pieces moves, unfortunately, really slowly. And so for us, we just said, how can we create a solution that we think people could use tomorrow and come up with something to actually help people, regardless of what happens, you know, legislatively, state to state, or, you know, even at a national level? We just thought, how can we put a solution in people's hands as soon as possible? So that was really the impetus for what we wanted to start with Amico Health, which was like, how could we get to an answer faster for people? Because frankly, time was of the essence when all these studies started coming out of, you know, the rates of depression, anxiety, all these things that have been rising over the past, you know, now decade and a half. It was like, you know, it's kind of been time for something.
Yeah, absolutely. While you at your age, sort of late 20s, I'm assuming, you're a digital native, and yet it wasn't until, you know, you were probably 13 or so that you got your first smartphone. Prior to that, you know, you weren't so exposed to the digital world like kids are today. How do you feel that makes you different from a kid growing up today? You know, someone who's 12 and 13 years old right now.
Yeah, I've always kind of said that we are like my age band of people you know, born late 90s, mid 90s, got really lucky because really we had kind of the perfect level of connectivity where, you know, I could go skiing and text, you know, mom or dad when I was done, and it made it simple to do that, but we weren't reliant on it to enjoy or entertain ourselves. And so even when social media sort of entered the fold, when I was in, I don't know, late high school, it wasn't like a part of life. People weren't so attached to it, and it wasn't really a part of social life at all. Yeah. Social life was really happening just between ourselves. And so even though there was this thing that was coming about, it just never was a central bedrock for any of my social life growing up. And so now, today, you know, you have kids that are 10, 12, 13 years old that are already worried about followers and following and these types of things. That has totally changed the dynamic of what it means to be a kid. And so I do think there was a huge difference there, even for kids that were born in the mid 90s, late 90s, to kids born in the early 2000s. It's a big difference.
Yeah, yeah. And then looking at your parents' generation, you know, we're all digital immigrants, we call ourselves. And so we know just a little bit about it. I'm even amazed when I hear about different emojis and what they mean, and how these young people, you know, are on the edge of their seat looking for the type of emoji that's either a positive affirmation or negative. And it feels so disturbing to me. You know, how does it feel to you as someone who, you know, co-founded Amico Health for the, you know, for the purpose of creating more digital wellness?
Well, it's, you know, it's an interesting point you bring up, because even me, I feel so detached from probably a lot of what those meanings are. And, you know, technology and social media especially is kind of the only true democracy that exists in the household, because it's the area where the parents don't know as much or can only really know equally as much in the best case as the kids. And so when this conversation is happening, it's like everyone's on an equal playing field. Whereas before it was like, you know, the parent-child relationship was very clear as to where the power dynamic was and who knew more about what subject. In this case, it's really like it's a level playing field at best. In most cases, the child is gonna know more. And so, you know, it's an uncomfortable spot for parents or for, you know, someone like myself even trying to communicate with, you know, Gen Z or, you know, or even that, or Gen Alpha or whatever it may, you know, what may come after, is a difficult thing.
So at Amico Health, you know, your mission is to help, you know, especially young people and their parents navigate through this to create wellness in the digital realm. Talk a little bit about the structure of Amico Health. Who do you have there and what do you do?
So our whole goal was, we knew that through psychoeducation, so teaching kids even just about technology, how it works, how different techniques that technology uses to maybe keep your attention or to create sort of FOMO or you know, these types of issues, even by teaching kids simple things that are built into technology that we use every day, we know that we could see a change in behavior, because we started to look at all the research and it was showing real promise when you were able to show kids some of these tactics. And so that was really the start of it. And we basically created a curriculum around these different subjects, around screen time, around addictive social media use, FOMO, body image, cyberbullying, and took different experts actually around the world that were creating different, you know, I guess you call them interventions that were specific for each of those topics. So we found someone named Dr. Sarah Dumoff, for example, who had created a body image intervention out of Michigan. And she found that by teaching kids to identify what images were filtered online and what images were not, actually gave them a higher self-confidence of their own body image, because what they did was they realized that what I'm seeing online isn't exactly right, and I'm actually able to point out things that are manipulated. And so our Amico Health became a sort of, not consortium, but it was a full program that took all these different pieces from great researchers that were doing this work, and we put it into one program that could be delivered in schools to organizations, and then also added in data so that we could make sure that we were actually getting the change in behavior that we wanted.
So you are a for-profit organization. You work with a lot of nonprofits, including a partnership with Live Like Sam here in Park City, Summit County area. How do you get your curriculum to the kids, to the school? Are you getting it to the schools, or are you going through therapists? How does it work?
So The curriculum itself is we go through the school, and depending public or private, the process is different. But it's usually delivered in health class, I would say, is probably the most common when it's in school. But then in after school programs, like we're doing with Live Like Sam, there it can actually be, it's actually hybrid with them. So it can be virtual, it can be in person. They have different sessions going on. So we do it with different organizations like Live Like Sam. We did it with Major League Baseball and the families that are part of Major League Baseball as well. So, you know, the programming can be delivered by any facilitator. Everything that we've created is designed so that anyone can learn to deliver the content in that way.
Yeah, that's great. So, you know, let's go back to body image because you expanded on that concept a bit. So you've got a classroom of kids and the curriculum, you know, how do you bring up these manipulated photos of people on social media to show them, or do you get the kids to actively point out, you know, what they think about that image, and then you show them how it's been manipulated? Or
exactly, I mean, there, some of these are, we always, I mean in all the lessons there are real-time activities that are built in, and in this one we've taken that intervention that she developed and just poured it into the classroom setting. So they're showing different images up on the screen, and then circles pop up as to where they've been manipulated. And, you know, here's probably why this person manipulated it. And then they learn also different statistics that are tied. So, and I believe the number is 71 or 74% of images that are posted on social media are manipulated in some way. So even just having that is like the, oh my gosh, everything I see online is most likely filtered in some way. Now I'm also seeing in real time how it's being filtered and edited. Now, like when I go on social media, I'm not going to feel so horrible about myself because these aren't really people in the end of the day. It's sort of turned into something different. It's, you know, it's an image at the end of the day.
Yeah. So what are the actionable steps that you use to, for example, have kids recognize cyberbullying and then have an intervention? You know, give us a for example.
So a lot of the times we're running through scenarios because there's different, you know, it's very difficult for kids to feel comfortable also stepping up in these scenarios because it's all also happening. The difficult thing with cyberbullying is it's happening outside of school frequently. So you've got school until, you know, 4 o'clock or whatever. And then from the hours of 4 to, you know, all the way through the night, it doesn't stop. And so some of these kids then are losing sleep because they're being bullied online, and it's kind of a continuous snowball. So I think for, you know, A, it's showing people like the ramifications of what that can do to a kid's life. And we have like a movie that we show as part of it. And there's some really kind of, I guess, informative content on what that can do to someone's life and how many people it infects. You know, mm-hmm. One of the videos we show kind of has this like little purple blob, and it starts with one kid that's being cyberbullied. You can see how many lives it starts to affect in terms of the parents and the friends of the parents. And it's an infectious sort of thing. And I think it helps people sort of think twice before they're leaving that comment or before they're doing that thing when you're thinking about sort of destroying someone's entire family unit. And when you see it in real time like that, it's pretty telling.
Yeah. I remember when I was a kid and that, you know, that hard time kind of adolescence, my mom always taught me how to walk away from, you know, people who are being, you know, mean and or bullying. You know, you don't need to be friends with these people, but it's so much more insidious now and so much more difficult to walk away. Do you find that young people are, once they're educated on it, are they walking away? Are, you know, and how are they walking away?
You know, I do think there's a movement that's going on sort of behind the, maybe it's not quite in public eye yet, I feel like, but there is a movement going on towards like less digital, more in person, more understanding. Like it feels like that's happening sort of behind the public eye. And I think in the next few years, you'll see people sort of revert back to something that's more normal to what other generations might understand. And so I do think it's happening, but it's happening slowly. And then it'll happen all at once, I think, but it's cyberbullying, I think, will be the same way. You know, you have something like, you know, Snap Maps is one thing, and I've had to educate myself as to what all these things are, but Snap Maps basically tell you where all your friends are. And so you have a lot of kids that are seeing their friends all hanging out and then they're by themselves, which can be mean, obviously, because why wasn't I invited? And these are not things that other generations dealt with. So I think it's really hard for parents even to know what to say to their child when they're seeing this stuff because it's so foreign.
If you're just joining us on The Mountain Life, I'm having a conversation with Bryce Baker. He is, he grew up in Park City. He's a sometime local, I guess. So he comes back all the time with family here. And he is the co-founder of Amoco Health. So I'm wondering, you know, there is also a movement. I was reading about this group of parents that came together in the UK, and it's just been infectious, keeping kids away from smartphones, you know, until a certain age. And parents are loving it. I don't know if kids are loving it, but really the bottom line is if none of the kids have a smartphone, then none of the kids really need a smartphone, right? What do you at Amoco Health think about those kinds of solutions?
They're great in theory, really hard in practice. Especially, you know, it can work really well in small communities, I would say, when there's, you can kind of band together, and Park City might be an example of this, but it's very tough when you have some kids that have it and other kids that don't. Because studies also show that if you're the only kid that doesn't have a smartphone, it's actually worse for you. So, because you're actually left out of the nexus of all the social conversation. And so it's really difficult to sort of say, like, we're going to roll back the clock here. I think maybe for next generations, you know, there's a big movement called Wait Till Eighth, which is like a wait till eighth grade to have smartphones. I think that generally makes a lot of sense if you can do it. I think where we came in was you've got communities at different stages of this. And so for us, it's about teaching the kids to understand what the ramifications are so that they actually are bought in. Because if the kids are not bought in, no matter what happens, they're going to find their way to this stuff because it's, you can't find your way around it, whether it's a computer lab or a friend's phone or, you know, whatever it might be. Our whole goal is to help kids be bought into this, not just the families and the teachers saying, go do this, because that really doesn't work ultimately.
Yeah. When you talk about parents playing a role in creating a solution and helping their parents, I think we all need to start with ourselves, you know. So often I'll look at a restaurant and there will be like the two parents and the two kids, and the two parents are on their phones, as are the two kids, and there's zero conversation among the family. They barely even look up when the server comes to take their order. And it's just, I mean, it's tragic. It really is. And yet I know that we all find ourselves sort of guilty of doing these things when, you know, for example, a really important text comes in from, you know, our boss or whatever it is. Mm. Where do parents start? Where should they?
Well, you just brought up one of the most important things, which is that like kids are really good modelers. And so modeling is one of the most key things, which is that kids are going to do what they see. And so starting with your own behavior when you're around your kids is probably the most important thing you could change. If it's something that's important for you to see a change in your kids or develop a certain type of behavior, that's the first thing you can do, is to sort of be attentive when you're there. Of course, you know, if you have to do work things, there, I think it's good to actually add some color and some voiceover, which is like, I have to handle something for work. Just give me a second, as opposed to just sort of doing it as if it's some natural thing to have always as an appendage on you. I look back, the first school that we ever ran with was in Oakland, California. And we had a number of kids telling us that they felt like their parents were trying to prove that they were being good parents more than being good parents. And that meant taking pictures of the kids, like, hey, we're at the playground, hey, we're at the whatever, as opposed to actually doing the good parenting stuff. And so it was sort of the kids teaching the parents at that school, which was kind of a cool experience to see that information flow go the other way. But yeah, we've seen a lot of pretty interesting things happen when you introduce it.
Yeah, that is so great. Yeah, parents need to know. I mean, I guess what you're talking about is taking photos of your kid and then the parents are using it for social media to...
Exactly.
Okay, yeah, instead of just spending some quality time with your kid and not worrying about... Yeah, I find that... So I have two kids who are in their late 20s, or one just turned 30. They, because they grew up in the age that, you know, that you did, and that they have spent so much of their lives with a screen in front of them, they do it for work. They don't want to do it. They don't need it. They're not addicted to social media. So when it comes time for dinner out with the family, they put their phone away. And I'm just wondering if what you see in your peer group, you know, kids in their 20s now, what they are doing.
Yeah, I think you kind of nailed it on the head, which is like, at least my peer group has, I don't know if it's even taking an effort because people don't want to be around it. It's like the time when we don't have to be, hopefully. You know, some of us have jobs that are sort of around the clock, unfortunately. So there's some element of always being tethered to it. But I think really if I can be there 100%, then I will be. But I don't think that's the case. You know, you mentioned this experience, you're seeing, you know, families with their kids at dinner. And I walked into to a place last week and there was a table of probably like young 20s and none of them were speaking. And so that was all head down. Like they're kind of like giggling at different stuff. And I think that gets dangerous because what algorithms do is they actually draw you apart because everyone's seeing their own thing. And so at a table of six, you know, one person's seeing something over here, one person's seeing something over here. It's not like what appointment TV used to be when we all sat and watched, you know, and this is even before me, but like, you know, there used to be one TV show that everyone watched. So there was at least conversation about that thing. And there was a relation between like, hey, what did you think of this? Whereas now you're all seeing your own thing that makes it very difficult to conversate about.
Yeah, that's such a good point. So Amico Health's digital wellness program is in schools and organizations. We know that it's that Live Like Sam is working with you all. What about any, you know, area schools in Summit or Wasatch County, or even, you know, as far as the Salt Lake Valley?
So right now in Utah, our primary is just with Live Like Sam. And I know they're doing it with Cache Valley Ski Team. They've got also programs with Summit and Wasatch County that are launching starting in July. And they're doing it as a 4-week program, which is separate from school. As I mentioned, it's in-person, virtual, hybrid. And so that's been really cool to watch them start that up as well, which is they're really great folks. And, you know, I've known who they are for a long time.
Yeah. So if there are parents, kids listening to this now, you know, therapists, how do they find you and how do they get the program in their organization?
So for Utah, through Live Like Sam, if you go to livelikesam.org/programs, you'll see us under digital wellness there. And so you can actually fill out a form through that if you're Summit Wasatch County. But if you're outside, you can go to our website, which is amico.health. You know, we have the school program that I mentioned, the organization program, but we also have therapists that help specific families that are dealing with more intense version of these issues. And so that's been something that is an effort for us that is important because, you know, we can't be in every school or every county or every program. So for some families, they just need help. We've been able to give them that.
That's great. So talk a little bit about your team. What's it made up of?
It's very research heavy. So we really focused on, we started to build the team. It was really researchers that were focused in this area, data scientists helping us analyze the data that was coming in. It's all anonymous, but we're constantly seeing that if our programs are working or if they're not working. So our team is mostly folks that are research driven and data driven. For example, the Dr. Marengo, who's based out of Italy, has run probably 80 or 90 studies on the effects of social media and mental health. And he's our primary point of contact for when we get data. He analyzes it and parses it, and we're able to then publish our own stuff, you know, even if they're not, you know, scientifically validated studies, it's our own internal work to be able to say this is working or this is not.
Yeah. You've got a really impressive team. I'm looking at it right now. I'm looking at about 6 people on your website, aside from you and your co-founder. Is that the bulk of the team?
That's the bulk of the team. We also have therapists that work in different states.
Okay.
So, you know, they're not all listed there. That's kind of the core team and folks that we've worked with to develop some of the core methodologies and curriculum. But it's all really, really talented folks. You know, some of those people are, you know, heads of boards or have, you know, been kind of at the front of their field for this subject or topic. You know, it's a relatively small community that is sort of deep on this issue. Mm-hmm. And so everyone kind of knows each other, which is good and bad, but helpful that we all have kind of found each other in building this.
Yeah, right. So I'm just wondering if, you know, say you are a child, a therapist that works with kids and you want a little more help in delivering the content for, you know, digital wellness, you know, would that be an example of someone who would use your curriculum?
So today how it works is we don't have a therapist training. We have our own therapists that deliver care. But, you know, we're of course happy to speak to anyone. There are some therapists that have reached out to us to say, like, are there any pieces of your curriculum that could be useful for me? And, you know, we're always happy to speak with people.
Great. Well, I've been speaking with Bryce Baker. He grew up in Park City. He co-founded Amico Health. I haven't even mentioned your co-founder. Can you tell me a little bit about him?
Yeah, absolutely. So Solomon, same Solomon Sherbin, and Solomon did not grow up in Park City. He grew up in Connecticut, but we were roommates in San Francisco. And I think being in San Francisco together, we both really sort of saw tech at its, I guess, at its height, or I don't know how you want to say that, but we were really living it. And as roommates in San Francisco, all you do is talk about business ideas because that's kind of what you do in San Francisco. And so this became sort of our passion and, you know, became something that we founded together, which was really a cool experience.
Yeah. So is this a passion project or is this your full-time job?
No, it's a job that takes 180% of my time. So it's a 12-hour-a-day type job.
Well, Bryce Baker, it's been such a pleasure speaking with you. It's great work you're doing. Thank you so much for joining us on The Mountain Life.
Thank you, Lynn.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life, healthy living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak. Well, acupuncturists Autumn Bear and Nicole Dreyer have become a staple in Park City's wellness scene. So too has Dr. Kelly Woodward, who recently retired from the Park City Hospital's Lifestyle Medicine and Wellness Center. They have all banded together to create the Autumn Bear Wellness Collective. And at the clinic, they're guided by the belief that blending the time-tested principles of East Asian medicine with the precision of Western medical science offers a powerful path to healing. This integrative approach allows them to deliver care that's both deeply rooted and forward-thinking. Joining me now in the studio to tell us more is Autumn Bear. Good morning to you, Autumn.
Good morning, Lynn.
It's great to have you back on the show. And last time we didn't get you in the studio here, but first of all, I'd love to hear about how you got the name Autumn Bear.
Yeah.
Because it's your given name, like on your birth certificate.
It is, I know. So my parents are artists, and I think there was a lot of iterations of some really interesting names kind of floating about in the 70s. And I was born in the autumn, and so Autumn became the first name, and my dad's nickname is actually Bear, and that's where the last name came from.
I love it. Those kids born in the 70s,
that's
to
it.
Artists, hippie barons, they got those interesting names.
That's it.
Well, it certainly is a name that you don't forget.
That's
we'll
right.
put it that way, right? And so now your name is on the headline of the Wellness Collective. You opened your doors when?
I opened my doors for the Wellness Collective just this March of 2025, and it's been a lifelong passion to be able to combine and integrate both the Eastern and Western sides of medicine, not just as a basic generic brand, but really trying to impact our community and bring wellness forward.
Yeah, it's so wonderful now these days because in the whole healthcare industry, if you come from the Western practitioner, sort of allopathic side, you're losing out if you don't adopt and learn about some of these Eastern practices. The same goes for in the Eastern practice. If you don't, you know, if you completely disregard this very, you know, time-tested as well, Western medicine. Can you talk a little bit about that balance?
Well, I think what's really important is that, you know, each of us in our own alleys, so to speak, spend a tremendous amount of time specializing and practicing in that particular side of medicine. It would be, you know, I spent 6 years apprenticing and learning how to be both an acupuncturist and a practitioner of all different aspects of Chinese medicine. I would never expect an MD to then dive in for another 6 years and trying to understand the depths of our medicine. And so when you take that in mind, what's really important is bridging the conversation between the Eastern Eastern and Western. They both play a very important role in someone's health and certainly in their wellness, and they both have a place. And so how do we bridge the gap in that conversation? How do we really bring forward great minds in both sides of medicine so that we can really serve our patients in the best possible way? And so that's really what we're trying to do, is bring that conversation forward. And it's also the convenience and understanding for each patient. When you are, you know, needing a doctor, you know, here's a great physician that you can consult with, but who's also open to other modalities of practice. And so when you practice together, that also shows the community that these are not opposing forces. Mm-hmm. These are really collective pieces together.
And very complementary. Yeah. I, as a consumer or a patient, if either of those Eastern or Western practitioners discredits the other side,
right,
it's such a huge red flag, because it shows me that they're not fully embracing,
right,
all that, you know, is at their disposal, all the resources that are here, especially,
right,
today. I have to ask you about all the acronyms after your names, because I figured a few of them out. There's an MS, a master's
in science. Yep.
There's an LAC, which I assume is licensed acupuncturist.
Correct.
There is a DIPL. I don't know what that is.
It's a diplomat of acupuncture. And so that's just our national certifying board that just basically says, not only am I a licensed acupuncturist, but I go above and beyond the basic licensing to stay connected with what is the most upcoming and greatest information coming through, not just acupuncture, but medicine in general. And that I stay up on top of those continuing education courses to make sure I'm the best practitioner I can be.
Okay, so we talked to a couple years ago. When I say a couple, then it probably means like 5 years ago or something.
Yeah.
And you were very busy then. Now your practice, it really was bursting at the seams, and so you had to expand. And you welcomed in Nicole Dreyer, who I don't know, but she's been in the community for some time.
Absolutely.
Tell us a little bit about her.
She's been in practice 15 years. She's a wonderful, wonderful practitioner, and she really loves practicing. Primarily, she's a pain specialist. But she's done all kinds of work in autoimmune conditions and digestive disorders, very similar to myself. She has a whole bunch of really fun modalities. She uses everything from tuning forks in addition to her acupuncture practice. And she's just got this beautiful, sunny, bright personality. And she's just such a wonderful, warm human being. And so I really feel so blessed and so lucky to bring her on board with me. So not only is she, you know, an incredible practitioner, but a beautiful person as well.
Great. And then one of my favorite healthcare professionals in this town, Dr. Kelly Woodward, who was at Park City Hospital and who was the director of what used to be the Live Well Center. And it's now the, as I said in the intro, and I always have to read it because I forget, Park City Hospital's Lifestyle Medicine and Wellness Center.
Right.
And he was my general practitioner, and then he retired a year ago, and so I'm so happy to see that he's joining you. In what capacity, and am I going to be able to get an appointment with him?
Yes, I think if you get in early, you'll probably be able to snag him before he fills up. He starts with us next month in July, and he'll be coming on in a part-time basis, and really his focus is looking at functional aging and longevity. How do we really bring people through the aging process in as good a health as possible? You know, there's a lot of conversations around, you know, lifespan versus health span, and it's really about how do we stay cognitively adept? How do we stay physically capable of doing every aspect of our life that we're doing now that we would like to continue to do up and into the future? And so his focus, in addition to being able to do chronic disease management, you know, he really wants to look at bringing health and wellness forward. And so that we're making those choices and we're really pushing ourselves to make decisions on our health that prevent us from being ill in the future and keep us well, so we can ski until we're 95. That's basically the idea.
Right. I know. In this community, it really raises the bar for people, because we look around us and we see people who are skiing until they're 95, and it is not, you know, they're not these outliers. They are just people in the community that do it. You know, you see people on the trails well into their 80s, vibrant and healthy.
Mm-hmm.
So you mentioned, well, there are these three words, lifespan, health span, and longevity.
Yeah.
Go into that a little bit more.
So conceptually, you know, there's this big push to live as long as possible. But living as long as possible doesn't really appeal to most people unless they're living at full capacity. No one wants to live to 100 but be, you know, in a wheelchair and cognitively somewhere else. Health span is essentially that piece of longevity where you're saying we want to both live as long as possible but as healthy as possible, right? So we want to have all our faculties when we hit that 100 year mark, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I love that. So longevity, quality of life, health span, it's kind of what you're looking towards, sort of the catalyst, your reason for being at the Autumn Bear Wellness Collective. And for those just joining us, I'm speaking with Autumn Bear herself. I want to talk a little bit about acupuncture. I hear a lot of people who are absolute devotees of acupuncture. And maybe they've tried various acupuncturists and various styles, I guess, before they find that person that is real, that really works with them. And I guess it's the same with any kind of healthcare professional.
Totally.
I have had acupuncture that I felt like didn't really do anything. I've had acupuncture, one session that I had that was far and away the most impactful experience of my life in this bizarre emotional way, and I thought, wow, this is big stuff. So how do we sift through, you know, finding and you know, there's acupuncture and then there's acupuncture. Can you make the distinction?
You know, I think there are a couple of pieces that come into that. And I think, you know, finding any practitioner, it's really almost an interview process. Yeah. You have to go in and you have to start somewhere. So you try someone, you know, they may or may not be your flavor or your fit. So it's always important to give, you know, to give it a chance with maybe another practitioner or two and see who really impacts your life and your condition. You know, for me, acupuncture is a relationship, right? Like taking care of someone is about the relationship that you have with that person because you see that person over and over. It's really important that you have that synergy with one another. You know, training is something we all have to have in order to practice, but training only goes so far and it really becomes down to that interaction with that other person that makes a big difference. The person that has a good bedside manner, the person who maybe specializes in what you're looking for, and who might have a different type of training that really resonates with your belief system, right? So I trained with an 88th generation Taoist priest, and that training impacts so heavily my perception of what healing means and what disease means, right? What, you know, from a Taoist perspective, you know, any sort of disease is really an opportunity for change, right? So I don't look at it as this negative, you know, impact. Someone comes in, obviously they're experiencing it in a different way. But when I have someone come in and they're really feeling the depths of that disease and they're really uncomfortable and they just need relief, that's an opportunity for us to make changes in places that maybe they've never had an opportunity to make changes in. It's a different perspective, right? And so they say, you know, if you're going to change your mind, you have to change your perspective, right? And so I think that's also part of it, is finding that person that helps you make those changes so that your life is a better life.
Yeah, that's great. Wondering, I also hear a lot of people saying, yeah, I got acupuncture one time and it yeah. didn't do anything. How many times do you think you need to have acupuncture and in what sort of time period to really be able to feel the benefits?
That's a great question. And that is a question I answer a lot. You know, it depends on what you're going for and how long the condition's been around. If someone comes into me and they say, oh, I've had back pain for 30 years, the fact that they might expect me to treat 30 years of back pain in one session is somewhat unrealistic, right? However they got there, it's gonna take a little time to unwind that chronic condition. So giving it that time is really important based on the amount of time you've had a condition. I would say the other thing is what you're coming in for. Acupuncture in its origination is in fact used for longevity. It's about transformation. So if someone is coming in for lifestyle and longevity, then they're going to set up a plan that's going to be kind of a regular maintenance plan. Maybe they don't need to come every week, but they're going to have some consistency and some regularity to that. If someone is recovering, you know, post-op surgery, they might come in for 10 sessions and be good to go. But most people come in for one reason and stay for another. So I get people that'll come in one, two, three times, and then they start to see the impact. So I would say, you know, talk about it with your acupuncturist. Talk about the realistic expectations of what you're coming in for and how long you might expect to come in for just treating. If you just want to do site specific, this is my condition, you know, maybe you're coming in for 5 or 10 treatments. Mm-hmm. But if you're coming in for lifestyle, that's a different story altogether.
Right. I also find that people use acupuncture, one, for this whole system, you know, like to improve the flow of your chi or whatever it is. And then there are people who use it almost in the same way that we get dry needling, where
right.
put the needle right in that spot.
Right.
Yeah. What's the difference? And what do you find that, you know, your job is to explain to people that may be getting, did I say it kind of right? The flow?
Yeah.
Your chi?
I mean, yeah, generally speaking, you know, we are, so our system of medicine is based entirely on both the channel systems and the resources that we have that support all of our life choices. So when we're doing a treatment for acupuncture, we're not just looking at where you have pain. We're looking at what's the origination of that pain, right? How can we treat that pain both locally as well as distally? So we're looking at the whole system of that person, their physical body, their emotional body, and their spiritual body. So we combine all those pieces together and we work on channel systems to help rebalance that person's body, whatever it is that's out of balance. Site-specific work, I feel like it underserves the person, right? It's not looking at the whole picture. It's just like focusing in a very myopic way. And you're like, oh, you've got shoulder pain. Let's put a needle in your shoulder. But that's not really taking it to the next level, in my opinion, in my opinion.
Okay. So maybe leave that sort of thing to the physical therapist that does perform the dry needling.
Right.
Yes.
Very different system.
I tend to be one of those people that when I'm lying on the table and I'm getting acupuncture, I want them to put like 50 needles in me. I want to, and then sometimes you'll get this, you know, maybe 3 needles that are very specific for one reason. Am I wrong?
So, you know, this is definitely one of those like more is better philosophies, right? And we actually choose the amount of needles as well as the location of the needles based on someone's resources. So for example, if you came in and you're like, I'm so tired all the time, you might have a deficiency going on. And so if we put in 50 needles, we're going to overstimulate the body and we're going to make it worse, right? So we do have to choose very, very wisely how many needles, the placement of the needles, and each point has a job. So when we're choosing needles, it's not just because it's going into a spot, but we're choosing those points because they have a very specific job that you want them to do to make you feel better. So more is not necessarily better. Oftentimes it isn't.
Sort of the fallacy of the way we think
right.
in our culture.
Right.
More is better. More is better. Okay, great. You mentioned several moments ago, I think you talked about autoimmunity and gut health. How does acupuncture address those two things, for example?
I mean, you know, we're looking at acupuncture as a tool of the greater body of Chinese medicine. So as practitioners of Chinese medicine, we use acupuncture, but we also use other things in order to treat conditions like autoimmune conditions and digestive disorders. So acupuncture as a system or a tool in and to itself, we are really looking at honing and priming the digestive system. We have all kinds of points for small intestine, large intestine, stomach, spleen, things that all influence our digestive process. So we can use that tool, but we also have, I'm a huge proponent of Chinese dietary therapy, which is all about the energetics of food, how our body responds to food, how we use food as medicine. So in a lot of ways, I will also use the tools of Chinese dietary therapy. We might add in, you know, cupping or gua sha or whatever other tools we might have at our disposal so that we're treating not just one digestive issue, but again, an entire body that is going to support, you know, basically creating a healing matrix so that we're able to heal from an autoimmune condition or manage it, right, depending on the condition. And then how to move our discomforts so that they're a little bit more balanced and less prevalent mm-hmm. in our lives.
Okay. What's gua sha?
Gua sha is a scraping technique.
Oh, yes, yes.
It's traditionally made out of water buffalo horn. That's like the traditional, and I actually still use water buffalo horn for my gua sha techniques, but you can use a quarter, you can use a soup spoon, there's all kinds of tools you can use, but it's essentially to scrape the surface of the body to move out stagnation.
Now that I think about it, my brother sent me some of those. I wonder if they were true buffalo horn.
I don't know.
Probably not.
I don't know these days, but I have a couple that I've had for like 20 years. So,
wow.
Yeah, I know.
That's something. Okay, we've talked on this show a lot about things like precision nutrition, which is, you know, targeted, trying to move people away from these trendy dietary things. And
yes.
to say that while the keto diet might be good for one person, it doesn't mean it's good for the other person. And hopefully it gets people off their soapboxes about evangelizing about which great new diet you should be on because
right.
they are.
Right.
Chinese dietary medicine, is that what you call it?
Chinese dietary therapy.
Therapy. Seems like it might be more along the lines of a precision medicine or precision nutrition. Can you talk about it?
Yeah, it's funny you mention, you know, the fad diets, because that is one of my bigger pet peeves, to say the least. You know, here's an example. People always come in and they're like, tell me about the blue zones. Is it a good diet? And I was like, well, do you live in a blue zone? Because if you live in a blue zone, that is an appropriate diet for you. We live at altitude in the mountains. It's a really different experience, and our bodies have different needs. So Chinese dietary therapy is really looking at both the individual and where you are in this moment in time, what your needs are, to help you heal from whatever disease you might be experiencing. But it's also looking at environment, right? What do we need to eat in the winter, right? We don't eat salads in the winter. They're too cold. They slow the digestive system down, and they can stagnate the stomach and cause a lot of digestive issues. So in the winter, when you live in a cold environment, for example, we need to have heartier, warming foods, right, that are going to support our bodies in these colder temperatures. We live at high altitude. We have higher needs for red meat because we need to build and nourish our blood so that we can have higher saturation of oxygen, right? So those are types of things that we look at in Chinese dietary therapy.
Okay. And eat lots of olive oil.
And lots of olive oil. Yes.
Which I love to hear, because yeah. olive oil is just a thing that I do, that I spend money on.
Yes.
And I love really good olive oil.
Everybody should love really good olive oil and spend the money on it. I always say to people, you're either going to spend your money on disease or you're going to spend your money on health. You choose.
Yeah.
You know, it's up to you. It's up to you.
So true. In fact, you gave me a statistic about what people over, or what retirees, so would that be over 65 or over 60?
I would
what
say they over spend. 65. Yeah.
Okay. And what they spend on healthcare throughout retirement. And this would be even if you are on Medicare.
Totally. Yeah. Okay. So the average, I was just looking at a Harvard study the other day, and they said that the average person above 65 after retirement spends about $157,000 just in their retirement years on healthcare. And I'm assuming, based on Harvard, that this is not looking at whether they're spending it on acupuncture. They're spending it at the hospital, basically.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. So, wow. You know, one thing that you put in your notes was a few things that are part of blue zones, going back to that since you brought it up, but a lot of it has to do with meaningful work and not having social isolation. And as we age, oh, the importance of creating new friendships and preserving the old ones. And
there's a lot of studies that have been done on, you know, when we talk about those people who are truly living both lifespan and health span together. And they've done studies all over the globe. And basically what they find, that the impact of social networks plays a far greater role in how long someone lives than whether or not they were a smoker or not.
Wow.
Isn't that wild?
Yeah, it's really wild.
Yeah.
I could talk to you all day.
And I know.
Suddenly we're...
Did we run out of time?
We're kind of running out of time here.
I know.
But let's talk about where you're located and how people find you.
Yeah. So they can find us. We are in a small commercial space right tucked back in Bear Hollow, right in between Kimball Junction and Canyons. There's a little village back there. They can find us at autumnbear.com. And they're more than welcome to give me a call if they'd like to, 435-569-7633, if they want to talk to me in person and ask questions. I'm happy to answer questions.
Okay, that's great. And for those devotees of Dr. Kelly Woodward, when can they make appointments? You can make appointments now for
you
when
can.
He
Yep.
joins.
His schedule is open on our website at autumnbear.com, and you're welcome to schedule yourselves on his schedule as you see fit.
Okay, that sounds great. Just last night I was having dinner with a friend, and she said, oh, there's a new study out. You know, it's always what's good one year is not good the next year.
Yeah.
But this was about alcohol consumption. She said women over 50 should not have more than 2 to 3 alcoholic beverages a week.
Yes, it's true. It's true. there's a lot of theories and thoughts behind it, specifically on how women over the age of 50 metabolize alcohol, in part because of menopause, and we could go into that in a whole other scene. But basically, the metabolizing of alcohol becomes challenging, and it can contribute to a lot of conditions such as cancer, heart disease, liver misfunctions, et cetera, et cetera. So really, that is a generally good recommendation. Or if you want, you could just... you know, have a little tiny bit each night. You know, moderation is everything.
Right.
I guess.
2 ounces.
Yeah.
It's the 2 ounce wine pour.
Maybe that's why we're all so healthy here. The Utah poor. They're helping us out.
Exactly. Exactly. Well, Autumn Bear, what a pleasure to speak with you and to have you in the studio. Best of luck with your endeavors.
Thank you so much, Lynn. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for tuning in to The Mountain Life here on KPCW. You can find this episode on kpcw.org under the Shows tab, or on the KPCW app, or wherever you get your podcasts at KPCW The Mountain Life. And if you like today's episode, rate us, subscribe to the show, and share it with your friends.